Say, oh, but they are so different.
Blog Talk Radio.
Okay. Are we live?
Well,
you're listening to Aramar Tefeo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
And with that caveat...
Now that's great. I still have... It says 9 seconds to go. Anyway, good evening, everyone. And I'll say good morning to our guests. It is... the 28th of February in the United States, and it is the 1st of March in Japan. So, John D. Rachel is here with us again. I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you for having me. This is delightful. And I love that introduction that says, this is for mature audience. This is like the political porn channel, folks.
Well, it's... You know, basically, it was because when I was setting this up, my brother said, you know, your mouth, so you better, make it for mature audiences. So
exactly.
Like,
yeah, you know, those four-letter words, man, they will crumble empires. You know?
Exactly. So it's like, okay, now that's the disclaimer. And we welcome listeners of all ages. However, you've been warned that, you know, the words and sometimes topics may not be suitable for certain people. So there you go.
Yeah, I grew up in suburban Detroit, and I'm telling you, it was a very industrial, blue-collar end of town. I mean, there were factories everywhere, all around my high school, for God's sake.
Wow.
So we learned the language of the street. That's how we express ourselves.
Yeah, I've heard... You know, people say, well, you know, any intelligent person doesn't have to resort to that. But, well, I don't know. Maybe you don't have to, but...
It sure packs a punch, you know?
It comes, exactly. It's much more of a punch than some, you know, six-syllable word that nobody really understands, including the people that speak it. So, you mentioned Detroit. I know you loved it there, didn't you, when you were growing up?
Yeah, like I like having boils and.
Oh really? I thought that you.
Oh, I hated
it. Detroit. Oh.
My, I say that ironically in my bio. You know that I was so that it's purely irony that I was so devastated by having to leave Detroit that all my social skills were arrested at age 18. I mean, it's completely a joke. My first memories were. How can I get out of here? This is horrible.
Okay, I didn't know. Because, I mean, you know, people sometimes are quite attached to their home where, you know, it might be something the rest of us might not like. Yeah, I've only been in the area a couple times. And, you know, I mean, I stayed a few days with friends. So that was some time ago before it totally became what it is now. But, you know, there's a few people who are trying to redo Detroit, and they're moving in. There's some organizations that are helping artists get homes. If, you know, houses in those depressed areas that will sell for $500, you know, with
exactly
no electricity, anything. But, you know, they're available if you work on them. So
if you want, if folks want to see the future of the world, they should go to Detroit, because in Detroit proper, there are organic farms growing on in an abandoned property. I mean, literally, people have resettled there. This is like post-apocalyptic America. It used to be, when I was growing up there, there were 2 million people there. It was total apartheid. There's a movie called 8 Mile, which is Eminem. And 8 Mile was the northern border. It was called Baseline Road originally. It's the northern border of Detroit. A black person would never consider going north Mile Road because they would be killed. So we had apartheid in Detroit when I was living there. 2 million people. It was also called the murder capital of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So now there's 750,000 people. 2/3 of the buildings are abandoned. But the irony, the amazing irony, is if you take a drive from Renaissance Center, which is right on the Detroit River, and you go on Woodward Avenue, and it heads northwest through town. It's this like the longest road in Detroit.
Right.
And you just drive it. You will drive through areas that look like Berlin after World War II. And then you will arrive in Birmingham and Bloomfield Hills, which is among the most wealthy areas in the entire country. You will see the extremes of poverty and the extremes of nauseating affluence in that one single trip, which takes about a half an hour.
Wow.
It's an interesting city.
Yeah. You said it's down from 2 million to 750,000.
Most of them were shot, I think.
Yep.
No, I'm just kidding. Most of them left because there are no jobs there.
Right. So they make a mass exodus. I don't know where they went. I believe that Chicago now it might have been 2012 or it could have been 2013, holds the record in this country for murders in 1 year. They beat New York. New York was coming in at 490-something, I think, and Chicago was maybe 512 or 513. So I don't know where Detroit is in there. We were impressed in a bad way because New York is like 2.5 times bigger than Chicago.
Yeah,
and Chicago had more murders. So
New York is like this peaceful utopia compared to Chicago.
To that, exactly. But, you know, New York has its problems, just like Chicago has Rahm Emanuel. So
people say, why do you live in Japan? Well, there's a multitude of reasons. One is that, you know, I'm married to a Japanese lady who happens to be beautiful, intelligent, and loves me. So that's a good reason.
I think that's but
the other reason is in 2012, there were 511 homicides in the entire country of Japan. This is a country of 131 million people. To get a gun here, you have to go through training. They have to vet you. It takes 10 years just to get a hunting rifle here.
My God.
This is the safest. And 511 homicides were probably, I haven't seen the break, were most likely associated with the Yakuza, which is the Japanese mafia. I mean, there's an underworld here of drugs and prostitution like there is every place in the world.
Yeah.
And so those murders were purely crime syndicate-oriented. You don't have, like, I read an article the other day, man demonstrating gun safety shoots and kills himself accidentally. I mean, what in the world kind of insane world is this that you have in America? I don't understand.
I don't think guns should be taken away. I think that there should be more training. Like you were talking about the people there in Japan having to go through a long, rigorous training.
Educational process, mm-hmm. One that instructs you in all of aspects of weaponry. But you know what? The thing is you can't take the guns away there anymore. It's beyond that point. There's so many guns that you can't take them away now. People are right. They need guns to defend themselves.
Well,
sometimes
right.
Within the family. You know, the husband has to defend himself from his wife and his kids.
Yeah.
So everybody's packing.
Well, that's true. And, you know, I'm not – people say, oh, but we use it for hunting. Well, I'm totally anti-hunting, and I'm very clear. Any weaponry I have is to protect me from other humans. And that's the way it is. I'm not worrying about the animals walking around. So that's just me. I'm an animal person. So
I love animals. They're so innocent, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't see animals crashing the economy or
no.
You know, or overdosing on heroin and
no. Now, I have one that there's a couple of things he might try to overdose on if I let him, but, you know, it's just food. And two of them look like they've overdosed on food just in general anyway. But, you know, they're not – they don't have those addictions. They're not going to go try to hold anybody up to get money. They have a better plan. They make me feel guilty.
Well, exactly. The art of persuasion, and they're so good at it. They look at you with those little eyes, you know,
yes.
and the little lip trembling, and you go, oh, I have to. What do you want? I'll buy you anything. You want better cat food, whatever.
That's it. No, this large body and then the face just looks like, but I'm starving. And, you know, there you go. But I wanted to say you have so many things that you are doing and have done. Songwriter, music producer, novelist, and blogger. You travel a lot, and now you and your wife travel.
We do. And I took a trip without her.
Oh, you spent 5 weeks without her. Uh-oh.
5.5 weeks. I said, Masumi, I love you, but it's too cold here. I'm going to go to some place where it's warm. So I went to Vietnam, and I went to Cambodia for 5.5 weeks. And it was a working vacation, by the way. I actually did a lot of work.
But
my breaks consisted of lounging on the beach, swimming 1 to 1 mile a day in water that was so beautifully warm and so incredible. It was amazing. Cambodia, folks. It's the new secret hotspot in the world.
Ah. Well, now I saw the picture of you on the beach. That's just lovely. And now you're saying
that?
Cambodia.
Cambodia.
There's a lot of people that I talk with on Facebook who are vegan, and they have moved to Thailand because of the food. There's year-round fresh food, and these are basically raw vegans. And so, I mean, they say the food is wonderful, it's inexpensive, and the climate can't be beat. So I would think that Cambodia would be pretty similar, maybe.
Very similar and very inexpensive. I literally save money by traveling there. It's so expensive in Japan that I actually saved money by going there. I eat a full meal. I mean, a filling meal, which isn't an American filling meal, but it's full enough for me.
Right.
For a dollar, or for $2, or $3, $3 maximum. That was like really splurging.
Wow.
Wow.
That just sounds wonderful.
And a lot of fresh vegetables. You go downtown, you know, and they have the marketplace, and all the ladies are sitting there in their straw hats and. More vegetables than you ever imagined possible everywhere.
And kinds. I mean, when I see the pictures or the videos, it's like, I don't know what any of those things are, but they look wonderful. You know, just kinds we never see here.
Well, we've become so removed from the whole process of producing food, and which is one of the reasons why, the way that prompted my first year around the world. I don't know if I ever told you, but I did something called WOOFing, my first around the world, which stands for Worldwide Opportunities in Organic Farming. And because I, you know, like everybody else, I thought food came in a package and, you know, wrapped in plastic with a styrofoam base, you know. And I thought, you know, I don't think this is quite the way it works. So I wanted to learn about, and I was very concerned about, especially in America, about the purity of food, about the astronomical rise of processed foods and sugars and all this, and all the additives and everything. So I said, I'm going to educate myself about organic farming. So my first year around the world, I volunteer. What you do is with WOOFing is you contact the farm through their organizations, and you say, I'd like to stay there these dates. I'm a male. I'm this old. You know, whatever. You just give a basic description of yourself, and then they say, "Oh yeah, that's fine. Come and stay with us." And they give you room and board, and you give them 20 to 30 hours a week of your time. And so I learned about permaculture. I learned about organic farming. I learned about a lot of other things, too. I mean, they weren't all ideal situations. But the great thing about it is that you're living right there in the community with people doing real things. You're not staying in a hotel asking the maitre d', you know, where you can get a taxi. You know, you're actually there.
Yeah.
So I woofed in Spain. I woofed in Switzerland. I woofed in Italy. Then Uganda, Kenya, South Africa, and my last stop was Japan, and that's how I fell in love with Japan.
Wow. Yeah, what you say is true. So many people, they are so far from growing. My parents always gardened when I was small, so I was always playing in the dirt, and I still love to. But I know a lot of people have never grown anything. They don't seem to understand. And that's what, you know, we were talking about, like community gardens in Detroit and all. I love these because they're getting children involved.
Yes.
And most kids, if they grow something and are able to eat it, it really makes a difference.
I'll tell you, it tastes a heck of a lot better, too. You know, I've had people say, I hate tomatoes. Have you ever eaten a fresh tomato? Do you know what one tastes like that hasn't traveled? Like, do you know that the average, when you set down a meal in front of you, the average amount of distance that the items on your plate have traveled now is 1,500 miles.
That's what I was going to say, 1,500 to 1,800 miles I've read. Yeah,
that's insane.
Right, when you can just go out and pull up a little green onion or a radish or grab a tomato off the bush, it's like, my goodness, you know, and it totally tastes different. A sun-warmed tomato off the vine or the tomato bush, whatever, there is nothing tastes like that ever.
Don't have to use chemicals, and you don't have to use pesticides. Yeah, you're going to lose a few to the insects. Or here we actually have, we have this big monkey that lives down the street that raids the garden. We have a big monkey, and he's an awesome looking guy. I'll tell you, I'm not going to tangle with him. But you know, so you lose a few to, you know, it's not a big deal. You know, you can. We always grow so much food that we can't possibly use it all. We end up giving it away. We give it to our neighbors, and then they give us the food they've been growing. So during harvest time, I mean, we have mounds and mounds of this stuff. It's very easy to do. It's very easy, and it's so pure. You don't have to use chemicals.
No,
you know?
No. And growing something that you yourself and your friends are going to be able to eat, it's reconnecting us on so many levels. So it's just, I mean, I would say if you're living in an apartment, you know, try to grow something in the window. If you have a balcony, by all means, get something going there.
So let me connect this to a political situation that just infuriates me.
Okay.
One of the big topics here is TPP here in Japan. Now,
right.
TPP has been being argued in Japan for 3 years. It's finally now getting some attention. And our illustrious, charismatic president is 100% behind this. TPP, besides destroying the postal system, which I've written about here in Japan, is absolutely amazing, is also out to destroy family farms. And what you have here is a very protected system of small farms. That's what Japan is.
Yes.
I'm sitting here and looking out my window, and I'm probably looking at farms that are owned by 12, 15 different people. They want to replace that with these big corporate monster farms. Why? Because there's money in it.
Yes.
And this is another example of the corporate mentality completely overwhelming common sense. Common sense says just what you said. You know, you plant a tomato plant, you pick the tomatoes and you eat them. But no, corporate America and transnational corporatism says, no, we have to grow like 7 billion acres in South America and then put them on a ship or a plane and burn a bunch of petroleum to get them to your table so that they can taste like, that they're going to taste like garbage by the time they get there.
Right, because they will be using GMOs and they will be putting all the pesticides they can find in them. I mean, that's what they've done to the farmers in the United States. There used to be so many more farmers, but they were bought out by some means were basically honest, but a lot of unscrupulous things went on. And so we don't have that many small family farmers with land that they can pass on to their kids now.
We just have those big, big, you can drive for miles and miles and miles and you see the same crop growing.
Well, the system was rigged against any possibility of running a viable family farm. It just was not economically possible because of the way that the system has been set up and the way the subsidies and everything else. So.
Right, and which is a crop, this whole subsidy thing, and then, pay not to grow and on. And it's, but there again, we know that the government is not wanting people who have independent businesses or farms. They want the drones. They want people to be smart enough to push a button, whether it's on the assembly line or in a cubicle. But they don't want people smart enough to think for themselves and act for themselves.
So how are we going? You know, I read all of the, not all of them, but I read as much progressive news as I can. I access Op-Ed News and Truth Dig and all of these sites, and everybody is complaining about the same things. There is a large body of very frustrated, potentially energetic people in America who see what's wrong, and nobody is coming up with a way to address this right-wing, corporate, conservative juggernaut that we've been experiencing for 40 years.
Right.
So that's what my book, An Unlikely Truth, is about. That is exactly, I try to address the gap that exists between the wish list that we have. I mean, it all comes down to this. You can say, we need to do this. We need to have, we need to just label GMOs in foods. We need to promote family farming. We need to do this. Yes, we do. But how do you get around a Congress that is bought and owned by the rich, the 1%, the corporate oligarchy in this country?
Well,
and with Citizens United and the pouring of vast amounts of money into campaigns and so forth, these people, even those senators and representatives who really have a conscience and don't want to go along with this program, really don't have a choice. So what I'm trying to do with this book, and it's a novel, by the way.
Right, and this just came out, right? This
just came. Well, it's actually officially not even out. It's coming out March 24th, but a special arrangement was made with Amazon to have a early release. So it is available on Amazon, and then it will be available on all other normal venues as of March 24th.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I thought it was out. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So anyway, to make a long story short, 2.5 years ago, I came up with this idea. I don't know if it's a good idea or if it's bad. I mean, my intentions are pure, but I'm not going to tell people that I'm 100% certain that it will work. But considering there is a complete vacuum in terms of a strategy for taking on big money in campaigns and big money politics, I'm throwing this out to the world and saying, look, maybe we can build on this. Maybe this is something that will drive a wedge into this system that has been created, which guarantees that we will not have representative democracy in America. So I came up with this plan. It involves setting up a lot of boots on the ground community involvement, but I'm hoping that people are angry and frustrated enough with the way politics is going, and we have a 13% approval rating of Congress at this point, the lowest in history, that maybe they'll actually get out and talk to their neighbors about this. But it's a two-phase plan, and it involves a community canvassing, a petitioning of the community in terms of exactly what they want Congress to do. Then it's the creation of something which I think is unique in our political history, candidate contracts, legally binding contracts between the constituents of a community and the people they elect, requiring them to perform in certain ways. No excuses, because if they don't perform, number one, they suffer enormous penalties, financial penalties, and number two, they're forced to resign from office. It's a very, very strong arm, sledgehammer approach to politics as it has been practiced in recent history. Now, 2.5 years ago, I throw these ideas out and nobody is, I'm not getting any feedback. I'm not saying this is nonsense or this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I'm getting nothing. So I decided to put it into a novel. Tell a story, how this unfolds. In the story, I argued the pros and the cons, the legalities, the moral issues, all of the things that you could possibly talk about. My strategy is in the novel, and the characters are talking about it and arguing it, and you see it all unfold, and it gives a step-by-step plan for how you can implement this particular strategy in your congressional district. In the novel, I set it in Dayton, Ohio, which is a military town because Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Air Force, yeah.
And it's a fairly conservative community in many ways. It's certainly not a progressive community by any. Although they have a lot of progressive groups and there's activism there, but they're very minor players. So I set it in this very conservative Ohio 3rd Congressional District. My lead character is a very bright, well-intentioned but naive young man, 30 years old, Green Party candidate. He's taking on this complete idiot, conservative Republican, who is super patriotic. He's got the smile, he's got the money, he's got the family, he's got the image, he's got everything going for him. This is the battle, and That's what the book is about. I mean, I think it's a good story, if nothing else, but the most important thing is that within this story is a step-by-step plan, because people always say, well, let's just go demonstrate. Well, demonstrations, this isn't the 60s anymore, folks. Demonstrations don't work. We saw what happened to OWS. Occupy Wall Street was, they knew there was something happening here which represented a genuine threat to the established order, and it was crushed.
Right.
So demonstrations are not going to work. My strategy uses petitioning and effectively what were called pledges before, but they're very, very ironclad pledges, which are accepted methods in our political system to use against the people that have been using them against us.
Yeah. No, I love that. I love that idea because I found out that not only in, you know, like it's so hard to impeach a president, et cetera, but a friend of mine has a very small, like probably the lowest besides school board, office, she's an alder person in a relatively small town. And she told me that there is no way that they can, aside from waiting for the next election, get rid of somebody who has totally gone back on all the promises they made.
Right.
There is absolutely no way. And
right.
So what you're saying, that's wonderful. It's a contract, like any kind of a job that you get that makes you sign a contract and you don't live up to it. Well, you're fired.
That's it. It's that simple. And all the contracts are written around key issues. It's amazing to me. You've got consensus in America on a number of key issues. And this crosses party lines. It crosses ideologies. You've got an amazing consensus on Social Security, on Medicare, on taxing the rich, raising the minimum wage, ending the war in Vietnam. Without showing my age, ending the war in Afghanistan, labeling GMOs, a whole host of issues that we, like 70, 72, 80, GMO labeling, 93% of Americans, they don't say we can't use them. They just say, put it on the label. This product contains GMOs. You can't even get that through Congress,
yeah.
93%. So what the contracts are, they're very issue specific. You go into a particular community and you say, how does this community feel about Social Security? 78% say that we shouldn't lower the benefits, we shouldn't raise the retirement age. Okay, fine. How did your representative vote? He voted for raising the age and he voted for the CPI, chain CPI cuts. Therefore, we're going to say to him, okay, you want to be reelected, Mr. Representative. You have to sign a contract, and here's how the contract reads. And I have it right in the book. It's written exactly the way it would on that particular issue. Then you move on to the next issue, the war in Afghanistan or the drones or whatever it is that the community feels strongly about, and their current representative is saying one thing and voting another.
Right.
And if that candidate will not sign the contracts, guess what? You have an independent, you have a Green Party, or you have a Democrat. You have somebody who says, no problem, I will sign the contract. I do believe in these things. I accept this is what I should do, and I'm not going to be able to make any excuses if you elect me because I'm signing a contract.
Right.
With you. And if I don't meet the terms of this contract, in it, it says, I will tender my resignation within 90 days of taking office.
Or we will just can your butt.
we will can your butt.
Yeah.
The can your butt clause.
That one. Yeah. No. I mean, what a good idea. Because now there is no recourse. It's just, well, he won't be voted in again. Well, please. That does nothing, because then somebody comes along and runs against the guy or the woman the next time that people presume would be even worse. I'm so tired of the whole thing about voting against someone rather than having someone to vote for.
Right.
You know, that, it's quite a thing. I've heard a lot of people talk about that. But
I think that there's two things that really, really bother me, and that is the fact that politicians make one set of promises and then when elected do something else, and they make all sorts of excuses and they say, oh, it's very technical and we can't do this and we'd like to, but we can't. Screw that.
Yeah.
We're sending you to Washington to do a job. This is what we want. Either you do the job or you don't go to Washington. It's that simple. And the second thing that bothers me is that we always talk Republican and Democrat, but as you said before we started this interview, you know, it's the Republicrats and the Republicans. We don't
have.
And
they're the Uniparty. Yeah.
Exactly.
So
it's an illusion that we're given some sort of choice. You know, what would you like for dinner tonight? Would you like poisoned meat or would you like cyanide? You know, it's like, well, thanks.
Yeah. But now you wrote a blog on that, the differences that don't make a difference. And,
well, that was a long time ago. And
but it still holds.
Well, I think so.
Yeah. Well, I did want to say that jdrachel.com will take us to your site and a lot of your wonderful writing. You just recently wrote Throw the Bullies Out, and that was – or the bums. I'm sorry, not the bullies.
The bums.
Well, yeah.
And I also did a video blog called Trust No Incumbent that I'm getting a lot of grief from people from. They're saying, well, I trust my incumbent. I said, well, have you checked their voting? I'm not saying you have to throw your incumbent out. I'm saying don't trust him.
Yeah.
Don't trust his words. Look at his or her voting record. That's all. And if you are completely and totally satisfied with the way they vote on key issues, fine. Vote for them again. But I think most people would be shocked if they really paid attention to how their representatives are voting. There's got to be some way that all this bad legislation is getting passed.
Right. Well, and some of them just don't show up, so they don't vote at all. More than we would like to think, they choose just not to be there because
they're cowards.
Well, right, and the people that elected them are wanting different things from the people that are paying them more money, like i.e. corporations, and so it's just better to absent themselves. It's a sad, sad thing. I did want to say that you, even though you've been writing songs and different things, your first book didn't come out till 2008.
Well, that was kind of an accident that I even started writing. I used to be a music producer. My first love is producing music. I had a beautiful recording studio. But when I dissolved my empire in America, or I should say it dissolved underneath me. I packed everything up, and I, like I said, I went working on farms, and I said, oh my God, I have all this creative energy. What am I going to do with this? And then I arrived in Thailand, and I have to be the only male in the entire universe that didn't know that Thailand was the sex capital of the universe. And I looked around. I went, my God, it's easier to buy a girl here than it is to buy a candy bar, for God's sakes. And it was fascinating. So I read this book called Sex Slave by a woman, and she basically, in 137 pages, gave an incredible, very disturbing description of the whole sex trafficking industry, and which is a lot of it takes place in Southeast Asia. So that inspired me to write my first book called From Thailand with Love, which is about the trafficking of girls from Thailand into America for prostitution.
Ah.
And that's how I got started writing. I thought, and I said, this is fun. This is almost as fun as doing music. And now I just finished rewriting my 6th, 7th, and 8th novels. So I'm 8 novels into this business of writing.
Okay. I guess I don't have all, I know that From Thailand with Love was the first, and then you wrote The Man Who Loved Too Much. You did 11, 11, 11, and 12, 12, 12, and put them together for a screenplay, right?
Right.
Blinders Keeper.
And I wrote a book to support that screenplay, right?
Ah.
Blinders Keepers.
Okay.
Okay, so here's my dark secret. the Man Who Loved Too Much, I wrote in 2009 when I was living in Nepal and India. And it's a very funny, kind of frivolous coming of age. It covers the life of this young man who, interestingly enough, grew up in Detroit from age 4 to age 28. And it's not autobiographical, but there's a lot of incidents from my life in this book. Anyway, I wrote this book over 9 months. It came in at 826 pages.
Oh, my God. In 9 months?
In 9 months. So I started shopping it, and I would get these things like 800 pages. Are you joking? Nobody's going to touch this. And I kiddingly say that maybe I should have called it The Man Who Wrote Too Much.
Okay.
So anyway, I moved on. With my tail between my legs, I moved on. I wrote 11, 11, 12, 12, 12, et cetera, as you said. So when I went to Cambodia and Vietnam for the last 5.5 weeks, I took The Man Who Loved Too Much manuscript.
Oh.
And I looked at it. Now, I haven't read this stuff in over 4 years. Interestingly, even though it was rejected by hundreds of agents and hundreds of dozens of publishers, the book has 14 stories excerpted from it that have been published in magazines. I mean, people love the story. Some of the stuff is very funny. And I'm reading this. I'm going, this is hysterical. So what I did in my 5.5 working weeks of working vacation is I split the book into a trilogy. So I have 3 shorter books now called The Man Who Loved Too Much, Book 1, Archipelago. Book 2 is called Entendre, and Book 3 is The Man Who Loved Too Much, Oxymoron. And interestingly enough, the book split beautifully into 3 pieces. I had to rewrite some of it because my writing was kind of immature back then. And that's what I did for 5.5 weeks. So I have literally, after An Unlikely Truth, I have 3 more books ready to publish now.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay. So we're talking, I mean, average a little bit on 300 pages or some, but anyway, not 820.
Michael. No.
That was a lot of writing, though. I mean, for a book in 9 months, 820 pages. Yeah.
Ridiculous. I couldn't shut up.
But, and this will probably be easier than to shop around.
Yeah, and I shortened it. I tightened it up a lot, you know, and I just rewrote some passages, but that's what I've been doing for 5.5 weeks. And I have to say, this is the most fun I've had in ages, because I'm reading this, and I don't remember writing this. I went, oh, my God, I wrote that. This is hysterical. There's some very, very bizarre stuff in this book.
Yeah, that's funny, though, because, yeah, you haven't read it, and you look back over it, and, yeah, you can see the mistakes and all, but don't you get that, like, wow, this is really good?
Well, I hate to say that, you know.
You can say that. I mean, I look at some of my things I wrote several years ago, and I look, and I mean, I might change it if I were writing it now, but I think, wow, I nailed that, you know? That was good.
Yeah, so, yeah. I was sitting, you know, when I travel, and this is going to show you, this is how, the way I travel, especially if I'm not with my wife. I was staying at a backpacker's guest house, right? So, and they have this big bar lounge area up front where we get great, you know, decent Wi-Fi and so forth. And I'd be sitting there reading stuff, and I'm laughing out loud. Everybody's looking at me like I'm crazy, like, what is wrong with that guy? But I'm laughing at the stuff that I wrote. It's really, I mean, it's not all frivolous, but there are some very, very funny things in this book. I mean, if people actually want to check it out, they can go to jdrachel.com/books/, and page down to The Man Who Loved Too Much. And there's links to some of the stories, like Dr. Genderbender and one called Spider-Man, which is really funny about this crazy old man in the, on the Lower East Side of New York. I mean, there's a lot of very cute stories in this book. So anyway, I'm hoping
that
this
so.
Time.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's good because, like you said, you've had 14 of the individual stories have been published around.
Exactly.
So it was just that huge book seemed to scare people.
Well, it's kind of, I mean, in the old days of publishing on paper, that would definitely be true. Because, you know, it would be like, it would look like the Bible, you know. Although, you know, Stieg Larsson, all of his books are over 800 pages, you know that.
Well, now some of Stephen King's are, because a friend has just started reading something in, I don't know, 800, 900 pages, whatever. So, yeah.
But they're right. I mean, I'm a new author. Nobody's heard of me. They're gonna, people would look at that and go, 800 pages? Who's John Rachel? You know, some guy with diarrhea.
Well, they better start opening up their mind and figuring out who John Rachel is. But because you had it before, but traveling around 20 countries and doing all these things you did, getting the experiences, it really broadened your outlook, I'm sure. And can get from not, but it's good when you can get out there. You've met people from every place.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere. In fact, when I was in Cambodia, two very interesting things happened. I met two people from Slovenia. Now, how many people can you say you've ever met from Slovenia? The country only has 2 million people,
and
two of them in Cambodia.
Right, in Cambodia. I mean, what a place to meet. Yeah.
And the other thing that was really interesting about Cambodia was that in all my travels, and I've been in 28 countries, I very, very rarely ever run into Americans. I mean, seriously. It's just, you know, Australia, Sweden, Germany, you know, every place, but not America. But in Cambodia, I met so many Americans. And I was trying to figure out why they all flocked to Cambodia. I don't understand. But, I mean, a lot of Americans and some real cool people. Some very interesting people. I met a guy named Pat Savage. He's a musician, brilliant guitar player and singer, and he's kind of the darling of the motorcycle clubs in America. He did like 3 or 4 albums that were like motorcycle rock and roll, and he's a bit of a legend, you know. And I ran into him in Cambodia, and he's become a good friend of mine.
Well, so why are the Americans going to Cambodia then?
I haven't figured it out. I ask, why did you come here? Oh, I don't know. I just wanted to go to Siem Reap, and I wanted to, you know, Siem Reap, of course, is the home of Angkor Wat, which is one of the great wonders of the world. So that's a reason to go there. But I was in a little beach town called Siem Reap, and I don't know why they ended up there, except that, you know, it's a beautiful place to swim, but there's beautiful beaches all over the world. I don't quite understand, but there were a lot of Americans, yeah, and very nice.
And they're
nice.
Living there, not just vacationing?
No, most of them were backpackers. They were just traveling through.
Yeah.
But I think that's becoming more and more a common mode now that young Americans can't find a job in America.
Yeah, truly.
You know? they go to Australia and they pick apples for 6 months, save their money, and then they travel the other 6 months. Yeah. I mean, what a great life.
Well, you know, they used to, years ago, be when people graduated from college in the United States, the parents, if they had the money, and if they didn't, well, somebody, you know, so many would go to Europe, that they would do Europe, because that was after graduation, you do that, then you come back at some dull, boring job.
Right.
And now what they're doing, I mean, it's much more exciting than just going to Europe for a few weeks. I mean, traveling all over the world, well, sure.
And this is actually kind of codified in a in Europe and in England and so forth. There's something called gap year. It's a very common thing.
Yes.
When you graduate, you take 1 year of your life because, when you get a job and you get a family and you get all tied down, you're not going to be able to do this. So you take 1 year of your life and you just travel. And that I've met hundreds and hundreds of Europeans, especially, and Australians who are on their gap year, young people, you know.
Well, that was something that several years ago I said that, because I was telling people that between high school and college, you need to take a year and not stay home, but just get out there, whether you're traveling, working, doing something, but travel and work as you go. I was saying all that, and then somebody said, well, that's the gap year. They said, of course, that makes sense. And I said, well, you know, that's what I've been saying for so long. And yet in this country, we have so many, they're pushed to, you know, leave high school, have that summer, and then get right into college.
I saw an interesting video yesterday on a brilliant economist. His name's Richard Wolff. I think he's at NYU. And he pointed out that in the last 30 years, the number of hours that Americans have work has increased 20%. And if you look at the same period of time, every other country in the world across the board has reduced the number of hours that they work on average. So Americans, folks, we're doing something wrong there. Life, you only have one life here on earth, whether you believe in an afterlife or whatever. It's indisputable. You only have so many years on this earth. And if you're working 60 hours a week, you are wasting your life. And there's something wrong with the system that promotes that level of labor. Think about it. It destroys everything.
But
you don't have time for your family. You don't have time for friends. You don't have time to write a book like From Thailand with Love.
Right.
You don't have time to do anything.
But that's what the corporations, because, of course, they're built on consumerism. So, you know, they advertise, and people think they have to have all these things to keep up or to impress people who don't really give a flying. Yeah. And, you know, you work all those hours to make payments on something you don't have time to use, but that's what is just pounded at people. That'll make you happy. That'll make you happy. Of course it doesn't. I mean, we're the one of the most depressed nations on the earth. And so, you know, we've had like some kind of a spiritual breakdown, a bankruptcy going on there. And because people think that objects make them happy.
So how do we turn that around, Ruth Ann?
One thing is by example, which is very, it's working for some people, but, you know, some parents, well, they have bought into it. A lot of people are unhappy. They're working jobs they don't like because they know that those jobs are not of value to anyone but the people making money off of. I mean, but they may be working in a factory making something that nobody needs or that's harmful to people, whatever. And so deep down they know that. So they're depressed about that. They go home and watch TV because they really don't feel like being nice to the family. And then they see more advertisements. So it's just that vicious circle, which we have to break. There's a lot of us who are living fairly minimally, who have chosen not to buy into the consumerism. And it's funny how people, you know, they wonder, and then they start seeing that you have more time, you're happier, you're not worrying about paying all those bills for something that's already broken, you know. But education, but it's got to be active education.
Well, I think people need to somehow start looking at their lives and just saying, what kind of, you know, I mean, we still do have choices. We're not required to live the way that we live.
No,
that's the
no,
reality.
We're not required to buy all those things that they keep pushing at us.
Right. So people, and a good start, and actually I don't mean to promote my blog all the time, but I wrote an article called Why Feed the Beast That Feeds Us Nonsense. And it's about watching television, and it's about a book that I read in the year 2000 called Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. And what it's about is not just the disinformation and the illusions that were fed by television, but the fact that watching television rewires our brains.
Oh, yes.
And if our brains are rewired, now we're no longer in a position to make any kind of credible, sensical choices about our lives. So the first thing I tell people, if you want to change your life, if you want to start rebuilding it into something that's meaningful and has some substance, turn off your television. Better yet, take your television and donate it to somebody. Or
I threw mine out several years ago, one of the best decisions I ever made.
And you missed it?
Not a bit.
There you go.
And I do get irritated when I have friends who will start talking about some so-called reality show. And it's like, well, you people aren't that stupid. Why would you, you know, all of this. But they've fallen into some kind of a little trap there. And, oh, my God, they've either got to watch it or they've got to make sure they record it because they can't miss one week of it.
Well, you know, it's just very simple. Television is addictive. I mean, sometimes human beings, the ingenious people that we are, we create things which are beyond our capacity to control. I think energy. I mean, Albert Einstein, when he came up with E=mc², he wasn't trying to create some sort of monster, but it turned into a monster because we're unable to control the potential of that particular insight that he had. And television, in a way, feeds in, and this is the point of this book, is it feeds into our nervous system. It locks into our nervous system in ways that we are unable to control. It is completely and totally an addictive vehicle. It is more addictive than heroin. It is more addictive than anything you can imagine. And that's why your intelligent, well-meaning friends who consider themselves enlightened and smart get into this stuff, because they really don't have They really don't. Television does not give you that option. You turn it on, you are instantly pulled into its world.
Yeah.
And it's working inside your brain. So I think it's a very simple choice, and it's going to hurt for the couple weeks, but after maybe a month or two, you're going to realize, oh, my God, people say to me, how do you have time to write songs and write books? And I don't watch television. That frees up 5 hours a day, right? You know?
Exactly. And I mean, so many people, and I have to admit that years and years ago, I was going through an unhappy spell in my life. I would go to sleep with the TV on, and now I just shudder because, you know, all this subliminal stuff is not for you. And
that's why I'm laughing, because you're your most vulnerable state. You can't even, you're not even to be able to reject the message. You're it's like sleep learning, you know?
Exactly.
All this garbage is going into your brain.
But you know, along the line, it's like, I never bought into that, like, the consumerism thing. I've always made good choices with that. Maybe it comes from my parents. I don't know. But
Did you grow up? Up poor? Were you poor? Were you middle class?
So, I mean, I was quite happy. And my parents had a mom and pop grocery store in a small town. And I know a lot of people, oh, yeah, you were spoiled, you were this and you were that. But no, not a bit. But I had everything I needed, not everything I wanted. Of course, I was a kid. But I did understand budgeting. I understood money. And so that's what a lot of people now don't, even adults don't understand. So I had that, and I just didn't fall for stuff. I've always been sort of cynical or skeptical about a lot of things. Probably the times that I didn't were like in romantic decisions back in the day, because I was pretty stupid like a lot of people were.
But, well, our brains always get muddled when there's romance involved. So.
Yeah, there's something about that. Yeah. You bring in sex and it's like, oh my God. So that's a whole other topic. But we were talking about like the people maybe not having as much in other parts of the world, but have you seen, like in Japan, when I think of Japan, I always think of close families with a lot of respect for the elders and not huge families, so they have time for their one or two children. Is that a whole wrong picture I have? Or
No. You're absolutely dead on, absolutely on the money. It's a much more innocent culture, and it's one that is very, very respectful and protective of the elderly. Many married couples, when they're first starting out, live with their parents, or even if they go out on their own, when their parents become older, their parents move back in with them for their, so the kids can take care of them during their golden years.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost a completely unheard of concept in America. I mean, you know, there's nowhere near the animosity between children and their parents, even growing up. I don't see expressions of parent hating and that kind of rebelliousness here that I see in America. And for instance, my new wife has three grown daughters, and she's very close to them. I mean, one's 20, the other, and she has twins that are 22. We see them all the time. It would not be unheard of for one of them to get married and to come live in our house while they got started, saving money, whatever. It's a very normal thing there. Now, I understand that's becoming more normal in America because kids can't get jobs, so they can't go out on their own. But I was explaining to my wife, the day I turned 18, I moved out of my house. I mean, that was like the goal. I'm 18,
exactly.
I'm gone.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
And now, though, you're right. Not because they want to necessarily, but families are, several generational right now because of the economy. And actually, I would hope that would be a trend like you're talking is in Japan. I mean, because people want to, because they care, because they want to be close. I think that would be lovely. I think community is important. And whether it's like the family community or me looking for that eco-village that's vegan, living in community, I think it's a good thing.
You would love it here. I live in what's called a city. It's called Sasayama. It has 50,000 people, so I guess it's a city. I don't know. But it's really basically about 12 or 14 villages that are all coalesced. I live in a village called Shinjo, and my little village here consists of maybe 30 or 40 family units. Once a month, we all get together. We go out and we cut weeds. We clean up the litter, which there isn't any here, but we still go out with our little plastic bags and our tongs, all the little ladies in their bonnets and the men dressed up. We go around and we clean up the community together. My wife goes to meetings every 2 weeks for the community here, talking about what needs to be done and somebody that needs help or whatever. It's a whole different world.
That's what I want. Yeah, it is.
That can exist in America again, but, you know, we have to turn off our televisions and go next door and meet the guy that you're living next door to that you haven't talked to in 12
exactly.
years.
Exactly.
Exactly. You know?
Yeah, I mean, that would be a good beginning. But once again, we're running out of time, John, and we always go. JDRachel.com. It's a wonderful site. I mean, the different books and the latest, An Unlikely Truth, is there. Music, blogs, it's all there. So I wish you lots of luck with this and in the new trilogy. So you're going to have to come back and we're going to talk about that and see how it's working. Right now you can get An Unlikely Truth. It was published this month with Amazon only. And then it's going to be available everywhere the 24th of March. Right?
Ruth Ann, I thank you so much. This is always a pleasure.
Oh,
twice now, so it's becoming a routine.
Yeah.
So I hope we get to do this again soon. Thank
you. We will. Yes. Okay. Thank you. And say hi to your wife, please.
Okay. Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
John D. Rachel in Japan, and now we have Zach Brown in the U.S. Hi, Zach.
Hey, how are you, Roseanne?
I am good. I'm so glad we got our time and everything together at the time. We were under the influence of Mercury being retrograde before, so Mercury's direct, and we're together. So,
yes.
Zach is the admin at Anti-Imperialism on Facebook, and there is a website also, antiimperialism.com, where all kinds of issues are tackled. And you yourself are a student, and you work, and you are very much a anti-imperialist. Tell me, how did you first get started in what you do, and not even just the activism, but what did you just grow up being against the empire, or did something happen to you?
I just grew up listening to Rage Against the Machine. Now, I had a very standard childhood, I guess you could say, growing up in the United States, in the Midwest of the United States. I grew up in a conservative and religious family. I think that I began to become more radicalized through my experiences in secondary education. Specifically, I was involved in the policy debate program, a program that's unfortunately going extinct in most public schools in the United States, but it's a critical rhetoric program. And so I got introduced to more radical authors, works of Marx and among other social theorists, and that began to radicalize me. And then I became more active online and among groups in the community, and then one thing led to another, and then one day I wake up and I'm the administrator of antiimperialism.com, one of the most well-read, far-left sites on the internet. So it's been pretty interesting.
Zach?
I'm sorry? Is that better? Can you hear me now?
Okay. I don't know what happened. I hope that Zach can call back in now. Okay. There you
can
are.
Can you hear me now?
Sorry. Okay, you're back. I'm not quite
sure.
Okay, so
no problem. It's just kind of it's just really difficult. Actually, cell phone signal where I'm located. So I'm just moving to another part of my residence. Hopefully, I can get a much better signal for you.
Okay. Yeah, it was just breaking up. You were talking about the I'm going to say debate, but you were talking about reading more radical authors and everything, and then all of a sudden you yourself woke up as the admin on anti-imperialists. Or anti-imperialism.
Right. To make a very long story quite short, actually, I was with my friend and fellow administrator of antiimperialism.com, Klaus Zelia. He also was, we were both involved in a project, a Marxist project called The Weekly Bolshevik, which is actually still a site that's being run. It's being run by some of our fellow organizational members. And we were approached by the then administrator of antiimperialism.com, who hosts his own show on this same channel, Nick Brown. Mm-hmm. And he offered us a position to administrate at antiimperialism.com and to edit and be involved there. And we happily accepted that, and that's where I am today.
Okay. Well, and you guys are really, really good because you're so passionate about this. And I've noticed that you tackle all kinds of things, from deep ecology you know, to stoop labor, Palestine,
right.
Favorite of mine. I mean, you really go for it. So have you learned a lot doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, 12 years of standard public education and a year of university education didn't bring me as much knowledge as my experience in activism has. I think that just even my short-term experience in it, just in administrating antiimperialism.com, has brought me into contact with some very intelligent, very knowledgeable, very inspirational people from around the world and within the United States that I've had the great privilege of being able to know and to be involved in these struggles and to be updated by the very people that are involved in them. And it's been very enlightening, I guess, at the risk of saying, in my own personal life, to be involved in the things that we're involved in.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, you mentioned your personal life. Have you found that most of your friends now are also involved in this, or do you have a few friends left over from way back or something that you get together with and have nothing to do with politics?
Yeah, that's actually kind of an interesting question. Yes and no. I think that I have a lot of my friends now, the people that I'm in most contact with, are either administrators or involved in antiimperialism.com or other revolutionary struggles or outlets, or are involved in political work or at least political on the ground. I mean, not many of my friends are not political, I guess I would risk to say. Not that I'm predisposed against that. However, I guess that's just kind of how the way the ball rolls. But, yeah, I still do have a few friends from way back from, elementary or middle school. I still see from time to time. And, we can have a conversation, and it doesn't have to be about, the apartheid within Palestine,
Right. Yeah, I have a few of those, too, but not – I mean, maybe more acquaintances that way, but not really many friends that – because it seems like, when you're with people – the things that are most on your mind are going to come up. And
right.
So, without just alienating them totally, it's like, well, maybe, we don't see each other that often, so we can spend a few hours and just talk about other things. But,
it's definitely a balancing act.
It is. It's because, there's nothing wrong with those friends we had before. It's just they aren't awake. And
right.
So sometimes it's like you just don't want to have to, I say start with 101 again and, teach people, but thank God there are people out there doing it. And there's lots of areas I need the 101 classes in. So that's why I look to you guys for that, because there's so much. I mean, I know things, but I may not know the background or the history of it. So you have that. Are you going to school full-time now?
Yeah, I do. I go to school full-time. I study. I have a double major in philosophy and Spanish literature. So.
Wow, and you're working. I mean, I don't even know when you,
Yeah, my schedule is, I'm not definitely not trying to self-aggrandize. I mean, I know just people off the top of my head that work, 2-3 jobs on top of political work, on top of going to school. So, I mean, I am by no means some kind of star and example, but, doing what you do, doing what we're trying to be a part of, what we're trying to do with raising awareness of these issues and trying to organize people politically, I mean, that does take up a significant portion of your time. But, I mean, if that's what you're about, that's what you're about, I mean, if that's
right.
What's important to you.
That's it. If that's your mission and that's what you're passionate about, it's
right.
I can't say it's always play because it's really not, but
no, it's fun. But I mean, a lot of times it is. I mean, it's work. I mean, you things you have to do, and you have to do them. Yeah. It's your passion. It's what drives you. It's what helps. It's what you look forward to in the week. When you wake up in the morning. But sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's fun. But it's something you do.
Right, and and there's no end to it.
No, definitely. No end in sight, at least for me.
No end in sight. we've got that goal down there, way, way down there. And so now it's just like, you know, taking the steps to get there. And there's so many things going on. Out of all these things happening, events in the world, the ones that are natural and the ones that are instigated, what right now is catching your attention, Zach?
Yeah. You know, if you would have asked me that question 2 weeks ago, I probably would have had a different answer.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just today, looking in the news, and if you look at our site, antimperialism.com, I mean, we just put out an article just this morning. One of my authors messaged me a few hours before I got up in the early morning, and he's like, you know, Zach, there's this thing going down in Crimea, you know, with the Ukraine, and, you know, we're trying to get information on, we're trying to see what's going on. So I was up, you know, I was researching, I was talking to people, but, you know, that's what's caught my eye so far is what seems to be, you know, if I might say, a Russian imperial invasion of Ukraine. So, I mean, that's what we've got our eyes on right now. We spent some time. I had actually written an article about the situation in Ukraine about 3 months ago, right when it was beginning, right after John McCain, former presidential candidate, Republican candidate John McCain, visited the Ukraine. I had written an article talking about the growing situation there. And then about a week ago, another one of our editors wrote an article about it. And then just today was the news of the invasion.
Oh.
Right.
Okay, there's a little break.
Okay now? Yeah, sorry about that. Am I clear now?
And we're back. So I don't know.
Hey, there we are.
Okay, yeah.
I don't know what the problem is. I guess it's just all the NSA phone taps on me or something. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
My phone is just having trouble connecting.
Yeah, and I don't know because I hear, you know, it starts to break up. And then I'm not sure. Skype can be acting up too, or Blog Talk. You know, so we have several options there. But you were talking about, you had written about this 3 months ago when after John McCain showed up in
right.
the Ukraine.
Yeah.
And
yeah, after he showed up, I had written about it. And then about a week ago, one of our editors, Klaus, wrote about it. And then today, with what was going on in Russia, we wrote about it. And we're trying to keep, if you go to our site and you click on the article with the update on it, talking about the Russian invasion of Crimea, you'll see that we're trying to keep a chronological update of what's going on as far as when the news is coming in, when we can verify what's going on there. We're trying to keep people up to date with the situation there.
Right. Well, now, let me ask you, do you, because I was under the impression that the a lot of the uprising there was due to the EU and the United States doing what they do best, which is agitating. Was that part of it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, this is a very classic example of what Lenin calls an inter-imperialist rivalry, basically meaning when two blocs or two imperialist powers tend to have a rivalry or compete over some sort of geopolitical goal. In this case, it's the Ukraine in particular. So we see that the United States, the NATO nations, the European Union are in direct competition with the Eastern imperialist countries, with Russia specifically, over the Ukraine. And so we see that, I mean, depending on the media source, you'll get a bias. But, I mean, the truth is that both sides are in direct competition over the Ukraine. It really, in my opinion, has little to do with the actual Ukrainian people. Unfortunately, they're caught in the middle of this conflict.
Yeah. It seemed that, the United States was wanting the oust of the president and wanting one that's more sympathetic to them, like they do in every country that they get involved in, where they try to take out whoever's there if he's not real pro-U.S. But yeah, I mean, Russia is sure not... what's the word, blameless in this.
Right.
But, I mean, maybe it would be better for them to get there than the U.S.
You know,
I don't know.
I guess it's kind of difficult. You know, I mean, I certainly would say that not everyone in antiimperialism.com would agree with me on this issue. I mean, this is kind of like one of those things where it's pretty much up in the air. It's more of like a nuanced thing. But I think that, you know, in some cases you might consider, I guess you could say, Russian imperialism to be the lesser of the two evils. However, yeah. I mean, the important thing to understand is that when you look at the big picture, that this is a conflict between two imperialist powers over a geopolitical objective in the Ukraine, and that, you know, the Ukrainian people who unfortunately are not self-determined at this point. It seems as though that their futures will be entirely determined. I had just read a headline right before I actually got on 20 minutes ago that read from The Guardian, where it said that, you know, the Ukraine hasn't had a genuine political revolution. What it's had is a change in elites, you know, a change from pro-East, mm-hmm. pro-Russian elites to pro-European, pro-West elites,
yes.
With the recent toppling of the Yanukovych administration. So, I mean, it's a dicey situation, but, I mean, it's going to be a historical one. You know, it's one that we can take example from, and that hopefully it resolves in the least violent way for the Ukrainian people.
Right. And, I mean, it's so unfortunate that they're caught.
Right. I mean, they truly are in some respects helpless in this situation. I mean, they did not will this conflict upon themselves, you know.
Yeah, I'm so over the fact that the United States so butts in with all of its power in so many places where it's not wanted, not needed, but they go in, and basically it's usually just to protect transnational corporations that are trying to steal resources.
Right. I mean, that is kind of the MO of imperialism, isn't it? I mean,
mm-hmm.
you have to understand that when we come to understand what the state is, you know, what the government is of any particular state, that falls into reinforcing the economic social order within that particular instance. So, for example, it's quite predictable for the United States to protect the interests of capitalists within the United States. It's quite predictable for mm-hmm. the Russian imperial state to protect the interests of capitalists within the Russian imperial state. I mean, this is
sure.
the function of imperialism in our contemporary order, that these states do not act on the for the benefit of the working people or for the oppressed people or even for their quote-unquote people as a broad whole. They act on behalf of business interests, of corporate interests.
Yeah, and that's just, well, pretty sad. What can people do here? I mean, is there anything we can do about what's going on right now in Ukraine? Maybe not. Is there another issue that we could tackle in this country?
Well, I think that there's a ton of issues to tackle in this country. But, I mean, in specific to the question of the Ukraine, what can we do? I mean, there's a lot of ideas circulating around. There's even been some organizations, unfortunately, that have been, I guess you could say, unwise or unnuanced enough to actually lend their support to one side or the other, not realizing the full scope of the situation. I think that the thing that you can do if you're in the United States is to, one, be vocal about actually describing the situation, you know, call it what it is. You know, as Mao said, you know, correct practice comes from correct theory. You know, we have to really understand what we're talking about before we decide how to act on it. So we need to call it what it is. It is imperialism. It's an imperialist rivalry, and we need to see it as such. The second thing that we can do specifically as Americans is to practice what Lenin called revolutionary defeatism, essentially, which is a really long phrase for saying, you know, don't support your country when it bombs other people, essentially. So if blows come to blows, I'm not going to be supporting a U.S. Bombing of the Ukraine or any installations thereof, you know. I fully support the self-determined features of the Ukrainian people, that the Ukrainian people should be there to decide their own future, that I'm not going to stand lock and step if the United States decides to militarily get involved. I think that's the biggest thing, is to just resist that sort of aggression by your respective nations.
Yeah. Let me ask you, I just wondered, do you think
that the U.S. is going to reinstate the draft anytime soon?
Because you know, that's
in so many places. But does the fact that they've bottomed out the economy keep them from reinstating? Because people go into the service because even though they may not believe in it, they think they're going to at least have money or get an education or something.
Right. You know, that's honestly a great question. Perhaps more for an expert of public policy, but I would say that just from my knowledge of the situation, I don't know if the draft is going to come back into question, simply because I think that the United States military, in the way, and you see this recently with Chuck Hagel, I think is his name, the current defense minister, defense secretary of the United States, wants to reduce the size of the military. And the reason is quite simple, because the United States imperialism is able to accomplish its goal with less and less people, with the increased intensity of technology. For example, the use of drones. The use of logistics and communications.
Okay.
So I don't think a draft would ever become necessary unless there was some sort of massive, cataclysmic conflict that required, you know, millions of soldiers to be deployed. Because I think that imperialism can ultimately accomplish its goal with less and less people today.
Oh, okay. So the people who will keep joining would have to actually have a dose of sense and not join before the numbers would get so low that they would have to force it then. Okay, now that
right.
makes sense.
Right, because if you look at the numbers of enrollees in the military today, it's quite different even from 40 years ago. For example, you still see that there are a great amount of people that join the military for economic reasons to make a job, but, I mean, that role has decreased. I mean, more so you see now with the transformation of the United States military is that more and more people are joining for legacy reasons, for, you know, their conception of honor or duty, or their family did it, or their dad did it, or their uncle did it, and it's, you know, it's about serving your country or, you know, whatever moral, ideological reason they
That's
have.
That's such a crop. I mean, why now? Don't they get it? Is this not honorable? I guess not.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's what Althusser, you know, calls an ideological state apparatus. I mean, that's a big fancy word for how imperialism and how capitalism makes what we think seem common sense, right? So, like, these ideas of nationalism, of imperialism, of our, quote-unquote, national duty to our country to serve, these are common sense ideas, or at least that's how they're taught to us in school systems.
Right.
However, they're not. They're ideological products. You know, these are things that are constructed for a specific purpose, but they tend to come across as common sense because, I mean, that's the best type of indoctrination, isn't it? Is the one where you embrace it, you know, where it's not forced upon you.
Without really thinking about what it means, because I've had several people tell me, oh, like, you know, they want to go and serve in the military because, you know, they want to protect us. Or somebody will say, oh, you know, my son joined, you know, he's going to protect the United States and protect you. And, you know, because I'll say something, they say, well, he's protecting you. And it's like, he's not protecting me. You know, do I look like I'm a multinational corporation?
Right. I mean, that's just one of the most ridiculous things. I mean, it's really difficult to even give that kind of argument the time of day when you just think about the history of the United States, its previous military engagements. Like, which one of them has been about defending American citizens? You know, the one in Afghanistan, where we were. Where we were building pipelines through Afghanistan? Was it the one in Iraq where we were dethroning a political enemy? I mean, which one is it? You know,
right.
I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's a hoax. It really is, you know.
And
how best do we
educate people on true history, on you know, past history and current? how's the best way? Because we know that if they're going home watching mainstream media, they're totally in another world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the best, I mean, if I really want to say, go to antiimperialism.com. No, I mean, that's just self-promoting. But
it's a great site. We want to advertise it, yeah.
Right. Right. I mean, it is a good site. I hope that, you know, people can actually get something away from it. I mean, we're not making any money out of it. We're not, like, you know, lining our pockets. We don't have some ulterior motive. And we really just are trying to help people understand the social order that they live in so that they can change it for the better. But that's another point entirely. I think that the way in which you can educate people is to, first and foremost, try to relate. I mean, when you're trying to educate people about something as complex and perhaps as natural to them as, you know, because, I mean, when you think about your life before being radical, you know, nothing really seemed weird. You know, everything was kind of normal. The police were normal. The military was normal. All of these things were normal, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
First and foremost, we shouldn't try to alienate people. We shouldn't try to – I'm not a big fan of, like, demonizing people for what they think or alienating them, you know. Truly, we want to try to relate to the masses. We want to try to exchange experiences with them. So if I'm trying to teach someone or educate them at least about, for example, imperialism, I'll try to relate to them about, like, for example, like you said, who does our military really serve? I'll ask them, you know, you've worked your whole life, you know, but do you really think that the military is protecting your interests? Because the people they're killing have also worked their entire lives.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, essentially this is a system in which the working people and the oppressed people are subordinated to the interests of paper, of capital, of money. You know, that we are essentially we're essentially numbers on a computer screen in many ways.
Absolutely.
You know, that we really don't have a meaning. We don't have any human value to a lot of these institutions. You know, as much as they try to talk it up, it's all about maintaining certain power relationships for them. And so I try to ask people, I say, is this the kind of system you want? You know, do you really want to live in a system where, you know, women and children, and that's patriarchal to say, I mean, innocent people in general are being murdered every day by the illegal use of drones or the occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq or many other places that the United States and other imperialist powers have occupied? Are you okay with living in that system? Because I'm not. You know, I'm not okay with living in a world of such merciless brutality for wealth, for the accumulation of paper money, of something so superficial, you know, the social power embodied within money. You know, I mean, that is truly something awesome. Awesome not in a good way, but awesome in a terrible way. You know, that droves of people can simply be annihilated for the pursuit of this commodity which we give so much value to, you know. So I think, like I said, back to the original point, I think that educating people has to come from a very, very genuine, a very sincere level.
Right, and be kind.
right.
Doing it, yeah. But is there something, you know, earlier, I guess it was John in the first hour, mentioned something about the 70s or something, and anyway, it made me think about I read that there used to be you know, like informal schools where people would do whatever, I mean, whether it was with kids or adults, young people who wanted to learn. I mean, like in cities particularly, maybe they would just set up like a Saturday school or something. Is that type of thing going on now in any of the places you know of?
As far as are you, so you're speaking of kind of like dual power organization, as in, you know, or excuse me, education, as in educating people about their daily lives and, you know, educating the common people. Is that you're talking about? Is challenging?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely. I think that when you study what we call dual power or base areas or dual power institutions, meaning institutions such as educational institutions, like teaching programs, which challenge capitalism, which challenge imperialism, which challenge the social order, those are very important. And you see those institutions almost everywhere you see resistance to those social orders. You see those sorts of institutions popping up with the Black Panthers in the 70s in California.
Right.
You see these institutions today in occupied Aztlan with the Chicano people, with revolutionary Chicano peoples. You see this today with the Zapatistas and Chiapas in Mexico. So you see these dual power educational institutions everywhere because they are very important. You know, it's about, you know, if I at the risk of sounding very cynical, or perhaps even cliche is a better word, you know, the youth are the future. You know,
yeah.
How we socialize the next generation is incredibly important. Are we going to socialize a generation of individuals and groups of individuals which will challenge the current social order and which will seek to better it for the common utility of mankind? Or are we going to socialize a generation that is apathetic, that is okay with the brutality, the merciless killings, the oppression and the suppression of people? So I absolutely love those sorts of informal educational things, and I think that there should be more of them because they really do empower communities at the local level, but they're part of something bigger as well.
Right. Yeah. Of course, you're connected on the internet and everything, so how much of what you yourself personally are doing do you, how much of that is in sync with somebody, say, in the Ukraine? We've been talking about Ukraine. Have you, and the person that was writing the article, Josh, have you talked with anyone there, or have you just talked with people from Ukraine who are elsewhere, or how deep do you get into it with people on the ground?
You know, unfortunately, the Ukraine isn't the best example of our on-the-ground communications. We do have people from the Ukraine that do not live there currently. We have comrades that live in the region surrounding the Ukraine, that live in Europe much closer, that can give us a much better glimpse into the media there, and so we can try to discern what's true and what's false in a better way. But we do try to establish that sort of communication that you're talking about. The Ukraine is a bad example simply because of our lack of particular instance there. However, if we were to speak specifically about Palestine, we have comrades from Palestine. We have comrades from Afghanistan. So in that sense, we're much more connected with those networks of oppressed peoples because it is very important, like you said. The media can say anything, but, you know, speaking with someone that's actually been there, that's lived through it, I mean, that's priceless. You can't put a value on that knowledge.
Yeah. And, yeah, it's really great that, you know, because we do have people in Palestine, and also, and I know people say, how can you say something nice about Israel? But we have a lot of lefties in Israel, and they're being... What do I want to say? Well, punished, beat on. They're physically in danger.
Persecuted, definitely.
And they're being persecuted for sure. So I think then just about every place actually has people who have seen the light or are heading toward it.
Right.
And that we can talk to and work with.
The biggest thing. Yeah, the biggest thing that we try to do with anti-imperialism.com is we try to take a mix of what you would call your standard media journalism, you know, the standard getting the facts right, trying to be objective about certain things. But then again, we try to mix that with an element of theoretical reality and actual experience. You know, theoretical reality in that we're objective, but we realize that, you know, objectivity to a sense is an illusion, right? Everyone has an agenda to some extent, you know.
Right.
So we have to realize that when we're reading the news. And experience in the sense that we try to actually communicate and to be in contact with people who are in direct experience with the situations we're discussing, because we want to have that sort of introspective channel into those situations that will help us to further our understanding. You know, we don't want to just have the the casual statistics, the casual news. We want to have an actually intimate, very personal, very relatable account of what is going on, you know, that can only come from actual experience.
Right. Yeah. That was, I interviewed somebody, it's been a couple months more, a lady who was an engineer in Syria. And, you know, she was just talking about how wrong so much of the West has it, because she's a very big supporter of President Assad. And, you know, she was just laying it out. What she's like being there, and it was totally
right.
different from what, you know, I mean, I found her because that's where I was leaning too, but it's totally different from what the people who are sitting on the couches here in this country are getting.
Right. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, that's a perfect example too, because I know when all the news was popping off, when it was really getting violent, very popular 4 or 5 months ago, you know, you had all this kind of hype media about what was happening in Syria with really very little understanding from actual Syrians who were there, that were experiencing
yeah.
it, that could give their
yeah.
telling of what was going on. But this leads to a very, actually very interesting conception, which we actually touched upon a couple months ago in an article on antiimperialism.com, and that is basically the phrase, what makes a famine is ideology. So let's put it this way, because in Syria, when the president or when the Syrian army cracks down on rebels, it's seen as what? It's seen as despotic, you know, it's seen as terrible brutality and so on. And some of it is terrible. But, I mean, truly what makes it terrible is how we perceive it, is looking at it with an ideological interpolation of imperialism, of capitalism from the West. You know, from where we're sitting, where we're looking with our
right.
geopolitical interests, that
our
ideology is what makes it terrible, you know.
Yeah. I just
continue.
Want to say that, you know, we hear about the how horrible the army was, and she was telling me that she had to, because she had to drive from her home a little distance to where she works, and she had to find another way to get there because of the terrorists, the rebels. Because it was
right.
so unsafe. And,
oh, yeah,
you know,
terribly violent.
Yeah, so that's the kind of stuff that you don't get from mainstream media. They're not.
Oh, absolutely
they're,
not.
Yeah, it's amazing how they can totally give a different picture.
Right. They you see with, you know, it's kind of like the old saying, I mean, you know as much as they want you to know, unfortunately. And, you know, that becomes even more true when you look at things such as, for example, when you look at the crisis in Venezuela right now with the coup that's going on there being orchestrated by the far right wing with these supposed democratic protests, which are really being led mostly by a very by the bourgeoisie of Venezuela, by the rich, by the landed classes there that are fighting against Maduro. However, I mean, when you think of that, well, I mean, when the news media talks about things like, you know, hunger in Venezuela, It's terribly ideological, their conception of it, because when do they ever talk about the tens of millions of people that die every decade of starvation by preventable causes in Asia, in Africa,
yes.
within the global market, within capitalism? Why aren't those crises? Why isn't Fox News running articles about those? Why isn't CNN talking about the tyranny of capitalism in Malaysia or the tyranny of capitalism in South Africa? You know, it's ideological. What makes a famine is ideology, because the starvation deaths of millions and millions of poor people and oppressed people and working people in the global periphery, in the third world, is seen as normal by imperialism,
yes.
by capitalism. It's
yes.
seen as normal, and that's what's wrong. I mean, truly, that is what's ideologically terribly wrong with the social order, that we can see the deprivation and the destitution of literally billions of people as normal, as another part of life. You know, that's, I mean, that to me is unconscionable, and that's why I say that what makes a famine is ideology.
Yeah, but that's true. That's a good, very good phrase, and it's yeah. It's true and very, very sad. What, let me ask you, what do you think, well, I mean, I'm sure you think it's horrible, but, you know, the people in this country. Now, see, because I'm from the generation, I mean, I grew up thinking that it was horrible because I had a religious background, too, like you did. So, I mean, I had maybe more of a sense of what was in the rest of the world, too. But, you know, I had just never thought that this country that I live in, the U.S., would have what it does now. One of my, well, I don't even know what, one of my major concerns happens to be the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, where, depending on who you talk to, the unemployment rate is something like, it's between 85 and 98%. And
right.
there's been money, not enough, of course, because we know what reservations are, but the federal government has given some money. However, the tribal council, with nobody to answer to, they haven't put it out. So we're always asking for people to help because there's like three generations of the families living in a concrete block. And if you know, concrete blocks, they do not get real warm in the winter. You know, they have no heat. And so, you know, things like this, I never thought in some of our areas in the cities, it's, you know, horrid. People have no food, at least nothing besides,
right.
You know, some kind of
right. We are...
boxes of macaroni and cheese or something. But, I mean, how did this country get to that point?
Right. I mean, that is, I mean, that's a spacious question, fortunately. But the thing is that my organization, RAME, the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist Movement, we're involved with the struggle of the First Nations within the United States and within Canada as well. And, you know,
yeah.
I will say this, is that, the actual stories and the statistics and the experiences I hear from reservations within the United States and within Canada are something like you can't imagine. I mean, it really harkens back to stories of the internment of Jews within Germany. I mean, it is really terrible. The abject poverty of these people, the way in which they are simply deprived of the way by which to reproduce their existence, you know, with no stable income, no stable job, no access to health care or adequate education. It's just,
no.
It's terrible. It really is. And it's a
concentration camp. It is. It's sort of like Gaza, which is an open-air
right.
concentration. But that's pretty
right.
much what it is. Yeah. Totally dependent.
Yeah, and once again, I mean, it's made normal. I mean, what do we think about? We think about when you go to school, when you're a young kid, you learn that the United States began in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence, right? And then everything after that was really peachy. It was awesome because all these great white people and settlers came to the United States. Yay, we're all happy. We're all independent. What they don't tell you is that the beginning of the United States harkened the end of centuries of indigenous people, indigenous culture, and native people, and the nations and civilizations they built within North America. I mean, we truly, the expansion of the white nation within North America, within the settler nation in North America, led to the destruction of tens of millions of people and the enslavement
yeah.
of another tens of millions of black
yeah.
Africans. So, I mean, but then again, they don't tell you that. I mean, that's just...
No.
That's in the it's
yeah.
not even in the margins, you know. That's just
a lot of that.
That's just normal, quote unquote. You
sure.
know.
Well, it started with Columbus, right? Or maybe not. I mean, before him, but Columbus, the other people who discovered. I mean, they were absolutely horrible to the natives.
Yeah,
and
I mean I've never participated in Columbus Day, and I encourage everyone not to. I mean, it's really disgusting.
Yeah.
I mean, out of all the holidays that we have, it really is disgusting that we would celebrate truly a man who, and it's not like he wasn't personally responsible. He truly was personally responsible. When you look at the records, you understand that he was involved in the personal brutality and enslavement of the indigenous people upon which the island he landed. I mean... And he brutally crushed any slave rebellions. I mean, it is absolutely horrific, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, celebrating Columbus Day is just too bizarre. Don't do it, right?
Yeah, I mean, at least. I mean, if you don't buy into the whole, if you don't believe that imperialism is bad, at least believe that, I mean, it's just kind of weird to celebrate some dude that landed on our continent 400 years ago. I mean, it's just, it's kind of bizarre.
Right, because it wasn't like he discovered anything, because there had been people here for a long time. I mean, it was just the whole,
right.
That was what we learned in history books. You know, now, I never really thought years ago that at my age now I would be studying history all over again, because everything I was taught was either a flat-out lie or based on a lie. So it's...
Yeah,
And
it's in the history that we're taught is very Eurocentric, very Western-centric, very white-centric. I mean, why are we not learning the history as told by the people who lived here for 3,000 years? Why are we told it by the people that discovered it 400 years ago? Like, you know, it's just, it's almost kind of like they try to say that the history of North America began when the white man landed. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it doesn't get more racist than that, honestly, you know?
No. Yes, I mean, because there were so many, like you were talking about, well, tens of millions of people actually were here. And, well, they had their own issues and all this, but still, I mean, they had societies that were wonderful. The Cherokees had a written language. And,
right.
you know, so many things. And as far as healing methods and different things like that. So here came the white man and tried to shun all that away, just like when they still do that to kids. I hadn't really realized how bad it was with the schools sometimes that they put them in, you know, where they can't speak native language. So
right.
we're losing a lot of
native.
It's
really, I mean, I think it's a crime even by bourgeois international standards set by the United Nations. I mean, it truly is a crime to deprive a cultural or ethnic group of their tradition, of their culture, you know?
Yeah. Well, just for purely personal selfish reasons, I would say because it enriches all of us when we all learn from diversity. I mean, what's not to like there? Why? I don't get it. It's sort of like when you have the agribusiness come in and wipe out all the farms and take over. You know, you've lost all the different crops that the different farmers were raising someplace. And now you're growing corn, you know.
It's truly in a phrase. It is the subordination of humanity to capital, to the relation of making money, to the relation of making a profit, to the relation of power by the accumulation of wealth. I mean, that is truly what it is. I mean, the cultural value of humanity, the organic composition of humanity, our diversity in language, in culture, in experience, in history, in civilization, all of that is essentially meaningless to capitalism, to imperialism. You know, if it can be grinded into a profit, that's what's important. And I mean, it's horrific. I mean, I don't want to live in a society like that. I don't think anyone does. I don't think anyone should.
No one should. And but that's it. The corporations, and the main purpose of a corporation is to make profit for the owners. So,
right.
So that's why they love having numbers instead of names for us, because
right.
they don't have to deal with us. It's sort of like in the Army where they do the brainwashing and make people think that the people they're sending them off to fight are lower than them.
Right,
and, you know,
dehumanization.
They with the names they call them and different things. And so that's it, because you have to dehumanize someone.
Right.
To treat them that
I mean,
way.
Truly, when you think about it, I mean, they cease to become people as we understand them. They become merely objects of a function. They become...
Yes.
They're no longer a father or a mother or a husband or a daughter. They're no longer Jeff or Bob or Steve or Ahmed or Muhammad. They are now the enemy. They are a terrorist. They are whatever racial slur they use in the military nowadays. I mean, truly, they are simply beneath you as the subject that is sent there to destroy them. I mean, it's truly a very, it's a destructive and it's a terrible ideology. And hopefully, I say this with great optimism, that hopefully within 100 or 200 years, we can look back on it and we can teach people and say that is what was wrong, and that's what we don't do anymore for that reason.
Exactly.
You know, hopefully that we can move beyond it.
That's a perfect example of complete ignorance. You know, just look back
exactly.
and say,
Oh, man, those people really were messing up then. But there were some who were, you know, on the right track.
I mean, truly, I mean, when you think about it, I mean, think about all the people that thought the world was flat or that the sun or that the earth was the center of the universe. I mean, there are certain things that we hold as common sense. I mean, it makes sense. But really, the truth is deeper than that. The truth is more complicated. And over time, everyone begins to realize that. And I hope that's what happens.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wanted to speed up. I don't want to wait that long.
Yeah, me neither. Especially with the way things are going now. Holy cow, I'm going to be in a blood the rest of my life
exactly.
at this point. But,
well, that's it. You know, when you talk about deep ecology, which your site does, and, you know, we've got the climate change. We've got a lot of things to worry about, like, right now. And it's, you know, pretty much people, there's so many things to work on and get active
right.
and get concerned about. And, you know,
right.
we're going to be running into other hosties from various places who may not have exactly the same thoughts and opinions and everything that we do. But I think
right.
one of the things, we've got to learn to work together because
right.
we have major issues facing us. And then when we get that taken care of, we can work on these other things. And,
right. and, you know, there's truth to that. I mean, not every culture has the same values. Not every people is going to have the same values. People are different. People have different values and different orientation.
Sure.
That's cool. I think
yeah.
the important thing to understand, specifically with the environment, with deep ecology, with understanding the world, is that if I can't convince you with anything, if you think that imperialism is great, that, you know, killing people, oppressing people, subordinating people, profit over people, you know, all these things, that they're just fine. Everything's fine. Genocide is cool. What I can convince you on and what you cannot deny is that the system we have today is unsustainable within the future. It simply is not sustainable. The world is finite, the world that we live in, and the models, the economic models these neoclassical economists function on presume that we live in a place of infinite resources. It's not the case.
Not
the capitalist system functions on infinite compounded growth. That's not possible. Physically, the world will be destroyed. Humanity will cease to exist before that becomes possible, which is why we have to act. We have to do something. You know, global warming is real. The ecological
yes.
destruction, the collapse of our fisheries in the world, all these things are very real. And if we do not act, I mean, the longevity of our species and of the world is in question. I mean, it's doubtable. Maybe not within our lifetime, maybe not within my children or my grandchildren's lifetime, but within the next couple hundred years, if nothing changes, the world will become uninhabitable. It will be, the human race will literally be destroyed. I mean, there's no other way to truly describe the amount of catastrophe we are causing to the environment.
Right. And I like how you said that. I mean, even if, you know, we're dealing with people who are okay with the genocide, they're okay with all this horrible stuff, at least we can find some commonality in
right.
Hopefully caring about the planet and work from there. So that's why I guess we shouldn't give up on anybody. I mean, there's some people, you know, I say, well, I'm not going to spend time on that with them because they're just beyond whatever. But I may not want to spend a lot of time with them, but I do recognize that they may have an epiphany also. So,
right. I mean, we were in that same position too, though. You know, I mean, people, the truth is that everything is in motion. You know, atoms are always in motion. The world is always
yeah.
in motion. Social institutions are always in motion. And people are always in motion, physically and socially. So, I mean, people can change their minds. That's the truth. People
yeah.
can change. And it's our
yeah.
job, I think, to do that, to spur that change.
Right. And to give them the room, and like you said, I mean, you know, educate kindly. And there again, like, I guess any kind of salesperson, you go for what appears to matter to them. So when you are feeling people out, you can figure out, I mean, if they have a family, then they care about their family, so you go for that. If they are real big into the natural world, you go for that. I mean, there's
right.
you hit them where they care.
The points of unity Right. Points of unity. I might not be able to unite with you, Roseanne, in specific on everything, but I know that there are things that we can unite with for
right.
common struggle. And so that's what's important. That's what's important. I mean, that's important in everyday life and just solving problems at work and having,
sure.
you know, leading a normal social life, but it's also important, especially in organizing, you know, and how we are trying to organize people and what we're trying to do. I mean, it's very important that you're able to discern those points of unity as quickly as possible.
I mean, I really think that I don't think it's foolish to be optimistic, because I am optimistic, and I think it's we have a lot to be optimistic about.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
I mean, maybe it's just because I'm younger. I'm one of the younger ones. You know, I'm so, you know, energy, optimistic, enthusiasm. But I mean, I am enthusiastic. I mean, I am
yeah.
optimistic because I mean, I talk to people every day. I see the revolution in motion. I see the organizing coming together. I see people beginning to, you know, as we understand it, call it wake up, you know, to be enlightened and to come to knowledge of the circumstances and the social conditions in which they live, you know, and all of those things are very empowering. So I see a bright future, a future of, you know, of conflict, a future of an arduous a struggle,
yes.
but ultimately I think a victory.
Right, and we can't negate the rewards along the way, because that's what keeps us going. When good things do happen and people start getting it, it's like, okay, so I'll keep on, no matter how tired I am, kind of thing. I want to mention again that there is a Facebook page called Anti-Imperialism, and the website is www.antiimperialism.com.
Absolutely.
So much good there.
Yeah, definitely. Our website is antiimperialism.com. We also run the website weeklybolshevik.com. We try to post local news about organizing opportunities, about demonstrations and things there. You can find us on revolutionaryecology.com. That's basically our focus, our center for environmental politics. You can actually find our organization, the Revolutionary Anti-Imperialist Organization, movement, or RAIME, as we call it for short, RAIME.org. You can also find that. You can find a link to that on our site, antiimperialism.com. And if anyone listening or anyone, Roseanne, anyone has any questions, I mean, they can find me on Facebook, facebook.com/Zach Brown. I mean, I'm always happy to answer questions or to try to help people along or do what
yeah.
I can to further.
No, you're very open. Yeah, and that's what we need. So, Zach, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back. And
yeah, definitely. Thank you. Sorry for the technical problems, Roseanne, but I mean, thank you for having me. And I hope everyone listening got something out of it.
Yeah. No, I don't know if it was your phone, if it was Skype and BDR having a little fest somewhere, or what. Anyway, no, thank you, and have a wonderful weekend, Zach.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You too, Roseanne, and thank you again.
All righty. Good to have you.
All right. We'll see you later.
Okay.